what somebody did to you seems to be a reason to hate them. The willingness to let it go. We're going to do a lecture on karma too, because once, you know, these are all ways of undoing the blocks to enlightenment. The karmic propensity then, you begin to suspect, is why you can't let go of this particular thing. After much prayer, after much psychotherapy, after much everything you can do, it is still stuck there. And therefore, I think the next lecture is on karma, in which we're going to use kinesiology to pick up what the block is. Now that you can see what it is, it's easy to let it go. But when you don't know what it is, it's holding it there, and you're sort of up against the block. So the love then is a style, a way of being, and it's a way of being with yourself. Out of compassion for yourself, you're willing to let go of the things that bring you pain. So instead of going from the bottom up, we can start from the top down. Out of compassion for yourself, then, you're willing to let go of that which brings you pain, suffering, guilt, brings it to yourself and others. Out of love for yourself, out of love for oneself, out of compassion for oneself, out of compassion for myself, I'm not going to allow myself to fall into the pit of being so linked to something that if it leaves, I will then go into grief. Out of compassion. So that lovingness now takes the form of an attitude towards yourself and your own life and those around you. I don't want to put her in the position of tending to a grieving cat pop, cat daddy. All right. So out of compassion for everything, then, our willingness to let things go. We do it all the time as a style of life. One expression of love, then, is devotion. And in spiritual work, that devotion becomes more and more intense. It finally reaches the point where it's willing to let anything go that stands in the way. So we may think it's the small things that we're letting go of. We say, well, I let go of my favorite sneakers, and it seems trivial. Oh, no. The capacity to let go of your favorite sneakers and not grieve about them or be angry at somebody stealing them or something, the capacity to surrender your sneakers is going to be one of the last things right before enlightenment. Why is that? It's because you have that capacity to let go. You try and get some people to let go of something, it's really something. You just cannot pry them loose, you know? You're going to go to jail if you don't do it. Everybody's going to leave you. You're going to die of it. And they won't let go. It's like they're in a spasm, you know? All right. The capacity to learn to let things go, you've learned through small things. Could you let go of being mad at that guy for cutting in front of you in traffic? That's a wonderful example. Every day you get all these spiritual opportunities. Say, go ahead, man, it's all right. Go ahead. S.O.B. Then after a while you let go of the S.O.B. and you say, oh, well, we'll get there at the same time anyway. You know, rationality. I'm only going to get there 3 seconds later. Big deal, you know. So then you're trying it with logic, see. You're trying to think. So you let go of all this stuff about him. I decided not to kill him. And he's not really causing me any problem with pride that he's a better driver than I am. You're all the way up to reason. Reason says, a couple of seconds this way, a couple of seconds that way. It's all the same, you know what I mean? But we're getting there. So we're developing the tools and the techniques. The most powerful thing you'll need is really powerful capacities and the one-pointedness of mind to go the whole way in non-duality and Zen and advanced Buddhism. This is a capacity that you learn, and then when you really need it, because you're going to run into tests that are really quite powerful, stronger than what you think, both overt and not so overt. Because as you move ahead, that which is made uncomfortable or displaced in its control over and influence over mankind begins to get annoyed that you're moving out of that domain and threatening their domain. And so you start getting the challenges. And when the challenges come up, that's when you need the tools. So spiritual work then, out of love and compassion for yourself, and out of love for God, devotion to God, you develop these strengths, these capacities, this discernment. And eventually it's like a knife. You can cut through anything. You can lose anything and everything. Disconnect. Parents, grandparents, country, lovers, wives, children, dogs, cats, houses, titles, anything. In an instant, it's gone. So that laser-like one-pointedness of mind and the willingness to cut through anything, no matter what it is what's going to be needed at a later date. So we perfect it every day. We perfect that capacity. So that's a form of love. All of spiritual work is a form of love. We surrender it all as a form of devotion. Out of my love for thee, O Lord, I let go my attachment to so-and-so, or I surrender it to thee. The willingness to let go of anything and everything to God. In the end, you're asked to let go all of it, even physicality. Yeah. Even physicality. And, of course, the ultimate one, which we'll talk about at the end of the lectures, is the willingness to give up what you think is the source of life itself. And you're asked to give up life for God, and you see that the ego is coming to its end, but you don't know it's just the ego, you think it's you. And the willingness to surrender life itself, as you understand it, to God is going to be require all the strength that you've learned. So devotion then is a one-pointed willingness, and it becomes tested all the time. The expression of God as of love as devotion then becomes the core of Christianity and many other forms of devotion, whether it's Zen meditation. So in strict meditation then, it's really one's devotion that carries you through the practice of meditation. It can keep you sitting there for 8 hours non-stop, no problem. It can keep you sitting there 12 hours non-stop. It can keep you sitting there until you don't know what happened, but you apparently fell over from dehydration or something. Could be a couple days later, you have no memory of it. That capacity then becomes perfected, and it is a way of devotion to your own spiritual evolution. One becomes devoted to the evolution, and you see that this is a commitment to God and to all the higher beings that are calling you to do so. People say, how do I know I'm going to be enlightened someday or something? Well, I tell them, if you weren't destined to be enlightened, you wouldn't be in this lecture. Nobody except somebody who's destined to be enlightened would even be here. Who would be at a class on how to drive a speedboat? Only people who are going to get a speedboat, and nobody else is going to be there. By definition, the people who are interested in enlightenment, the people who are going to become enlightened. I mean, that's how you get there, isn't it? Unless you're one of those drop-off-the-cliff enlightenments, that happened too. And it's just as you go over the side, you completely and totally surrender everything to God. You go into an incredible state. Much to your dismay, you wake up 4 days later in a hospital. Everybody's saying, oh, it's so wonderful you're still alive. You're going, man, I was in heaven. And they resuscitated me. Thanks a lot. Yeah, it took me right out of that bliss. I'm really happy about that. Yes, well, it makes the family happy. They're happy now. He's breathing again. Okay. Good for Aunt Nellie. Oh, look, he's breathing again, Mother. Oh, golly. Any of you who have had near-death experiences know the humor of that one. So it's possible to stay in a very good state all the time, and one of the expressions of love is humor. Why? Because humor recontextualizes all of life in such a way that you can handle it without resorting to any of the lower levels. There's nothing to be angry about if you see that it's sort of absurd, you know what I mean? Oh, golly, I don't even say it. Anyway. It's a way of staying in the world. To recontextualize things, what is it? It's comparing the context of reality with the content of appearance, and you see the absurdity of the comparison, I guess. So that humor is one style, and people who become spiritually evolved often become quite comical because they wear the world lightly, you know, like a garment, and everything sort of becomes comical. And, you know, because of the contrast with reality, the absurdity. So it's the absurdity, it's the theater of the absurd that is comical. And, yeah. People don't expect that. They expect piety. Well, piety is profound. And the difficulty I had this morning was I didn't know if I was going to function because in a state of bliss, you see, as you let go of all these things, progressively life becomes more beautiful and more harmonious. The miraculous takes care of everything. A sense of inner joy begins to arise, becomes so severe that it can be ecstatic. In a state of ecstasy, you really cannot function in the world. In a state of high joy, you can't really function in the world. And in a state of bliss, you just sit there. I thought, maybe I'll just bless everybody today, but I managed to get out of it with the help of people, because this morning I thought, oh, wow. I mean, yeah, the state, you know, so having been with it for some years, one learns how to sort of be with it more or less. But then at times it becomes quite profound. It cannot be denied. And it just wipes you out. That's why it's good to have friends that know what you're about, that friends that understand it. To be associated with spiritual groups. You know, when I was a psychiatrist for many years for the Episcopal Diocese, Catholic Diocese, Catholic nuns, the Zen monastery, the ministry, for many years. And I had to discern the difference between these states. Is this guy in a state of samadhi or is he catatonic? He came down from the Zen monastery. Borderline schizophrenia is not a good condition in which to start a Zen meditation because pretty soon things start talking to you and flying around. Is this a state of ecstasy, true spiritual ecstasy, or is it religious mania? Hard to differentiate. Because religious ecstasy, I'm sure I can think of moments of my life when if a psychiatrist had examined me, he would have probably ordered Thorazine. So that was really my function. Does he need Thorazine, or should we all bow to him, you know what I'm saying? Because those high states can be very, very powerful. Ecstasy and joy. And the one that takes us out of the world, and the one that took us out this morning, was bliss. Sat Chit Ananda the presence becomes so profound that one really becomes immobilized by it. So let's hear that. Karen.